Borrowing a title from Verdi, we might call this story La Forza del Destino, The Force of Destiny, how one man's mother, his maker, and Mario Lanza all conspired to open his heart to his true love of singing. Ironically, we'll find the key was an opera-like tale of true love, the love between the prince and Kathy that was ultimately sacrificed for a larger good and a more expansive love in The Student Prince by Sigmund Rönnberg. Robert Mitchell reflects on his life and his loves in two memoirs, Tales of a Tenacious Tenor and more recently Sodium Balls, A Reverend's Journey, and even in two novels, Unlicensed Love, not yet published, and a sequel, Love Doesn't Lie, in progress. This tenacious tenor completed his operatic studies at Manus College of Music, and he went on to appear with Amato Opera in New York and other regional companies for 40 years, while working full-time at Scholastic Incorporated, the educational publisher, for 3 decades, and eventually becoming an ordained minister. It certainly might seem that assuming the roles of all two human characters within operatic stories of violence, betrayal, illicit loves, and malevolence of all sorts might be the polar opposite of responsibilities of the pastorate, but in his life, Robert Mitchell passionately and at times painfully has embodied real courage. And we remember at the root of that word, courage, is the French word cœur, for heart. He's followed his loves and leaves us with a sense that it's all soul stuff. Somehow in his singing and in his ministering, he's connecting others with a realm larger than themselves. Giuseppe Mazzini, a 19th century observer, contended that it is possible for an opera and the personalities of its characters, the distinctive musical colors that unify and also vary it, to be experienced as a deep revelation of the sacred universal mysteries at the heart of the human person. And Gary Tomlinson suggests further, the voice in opera and many other contexts is actually able to connect its bearers, the vocalists, with its hearers to realities beyond our senses. And so when Rodolfo and Mimi are in the dark outside her door and they're singing of cold hands while hearts heat up, might there be something more at stake? Mazzini seems to suggest that there can in fact be something of the human spirit, the human essence, seeping out from the singers on stage that might even color the landscape around them and touch their listeners deeply. Like young Robert Mitchell and the student prince, perhaps? Robert Mitchell was born in McVeightown in south central Pennsylvania, and he has now settled with his wife Joan in the Poconos, where he works as pastor at St. Jacoby Church in Chihola. Pastor Bob paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about his singing and his writing and how it all began.
I always sang even from the time I was very young. There was a friend of the family, his name was Charlie Price. They were good friends of my parents, he and Dotes. And they never had any children. And when they came to our house, there were 4 children. I remember them, I guess it was when we lived in Middletown, Pennsylvania. I was probably 4 years old, and Charlie would come, and he would make me sing at the piano at age 4. And I was scared. He was a cabaret pianist, and he was also a teacher, and he became a principal. My gal's a corker, she's a New Yorker, that's where my money goes. She's got 2 lips, just like potato chips, that's where my money goes. And then I would start laughing, and he would get me to sing this. So that was my introduction, I think, to singing. Later, when I was in high school, it was my 15th birthday. It was 1954. I remember it was in July, and I came down, and I wanted to go swimming that day. And my mother said, well, Robert, it's your birthday. And I said, well, yeah, happy birthday, me, you know. And she said, but I have a birthday present for you. I want to take you to see the student prince of Mario Lanza. You know, you love Mario Lanza, right? And I said, well, it's hot. I don't want to go to the movies. But you love Mario Lanza, don't you? I said, yeah. I mean, my sister, older sister, I was the baby of the family. My older sister was playing his records all the time. So I knew his voice. And, well, she finally persuaded me to go to this movie. And it was in Bellefonte. We lived in Lock Haven at the time. And my father was, at the time, he was a projectionist in Bellefonte. So we had to drive to Bellefonte to see this movie. And the upshoot of it was I was sitting through this whole movie bawling my eyes out. Of course, I fell in love with Kathy, just as he did. And, of course, Edmund Purdom looked so elegant. You know, Mario Lanza could have looked like that. What a career he would have had. But I coached with the conductor, Konstantin Kalinikos. I coached with him for a while in New York. And he was the conductor of all of Mario Lanza's movies. And I remember asking him about Mario, and he told me the story. He said, you know, I said, Mario got fired from that movie. I knew about that. And he said, well, you know the story, don't you? I said, no. He said, well, we actually fired him, but I'll never forget the first day he came in to rehearse these songs. And he came in late, as usual, and I think it was like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and from 1 to about 6 in the evening, we rehearsed each song one after the other, and that was before he got fired, and that became a soundtrack. He said, we cut it once, that was it. He said, I've never done anything. Usually it takes days and weeks to prepare a soundtrack for a movie, and he said that was his soundtrack, you know, all those songs. In the summertime in Heidelberg, there's music in the air. All the Fräuleins dressed in their Sunday best. Dee, 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 dee. And he sang it with that kind of falsetto-y voice. And I just, oh, well, that night, and this is a truth, this actually happened. That night when I came home, I was 15 years old. It was 1954. And all my brothers and sisters, my older sister was married, the other sister was away in college, and my brother was in the Navy, so I had the house all to myself. So I went out in the backyard that night. It was a beautiful night. And I looked up at the stars. I said, God, I gotta sing like that. I wanna sing like Mario. That was the beginning of my singing career. Took lessons with my high school teacher, and she said, oh, Bob, don't even think about it. You'll never make it. And everybody thought I was a baritone. In high school, they put me into baritone section. And even when I got to Mansfield, Jack Wilcox was my teacher. You remember Jack?
What was the deciding factor when you knew inside yourself you were a tenor? When did you officially become a tenor?
In 1960, it's a famous summer, I think I even call the chapter that, the famous summer of 1960, Ocean Grove, well, I call it Ocean Grove, the life-changing summer. That summer, I was a bellhop, and I met all kinds of singers. I also was the elevator operator in the North End Hotel, which unfortunately was torn down in 1984. I met a young man, his name is Jim DeHaven, who fabulous pianist. He was younger than I. He was also an accomplished baritone. And I had never heard a baritone voice like that. It's coming from a small town, everybody was a baritone and everybody sang pretty much the same. But this was an operatic baritone voice. And he said, Bob, you're not a baritone. So he said, why don't you come with me? He said, this fall, I'm going into New York, and I'm auditioning at the Manus College of Music. Why don't you come along? And I said, what? You know, it was so far out of my scope. You know, the first thing was fear that crossed my mind. And with $3 in my pocket, I went in to New York, and I auditioned for Mr. Sanger, Marcial Sanger, who, as you know, is a famous Metropolitan Opera baritone. And I don't remember what I sang for him. You know, I said, I think I'm a baritone. You know, everybody tells me I'm a baritone. I think I should be a tenor. And after I sang for him, he said, "Well, my dear, I think you are a tenor. And we will see. Let us see." And he accepted me as a student. I didn't get to study with him the first year. I had another teacher. And then it took me, I had spent a year at Lock Haven Teachers College, then 2 years at Mansfield. Then it took me another 4 years to complete, because I had to have 3 years of opera workshop in order to have my Bachelor of Science in Voice and Opera. And they wouldn't let me do the opera the first year, the opera workshop. So it took me 4 years, and that was at Manus. But I was very fortunate because I met my wife there. I walked in to the registrar's office, and who was sitting there but Maddie, who was the registrar, an older woman, and this lovely young woman sitting over to her left, to my right. And I ended up marrying her 2 years later. And she was a soprano, and she also is very good at languages, and she helped me learn all my roles. She helped me learn Italian, French, and German. And Mr. Sanger once told me, in one of my lessons, he said, "You know, my dear Joan, your wife, I don't know whether she speaks the language or not, but when she sings, her pronunciation is absolutely perfect in French." And coming from Mr. Sanger, he was a taskmaster. If you ever see any of his videos, he's on YouTube. A lot of people have put up lessons of him teaching lessons, and you'll see how he was a tough taskmaster, even on these videos when he had an audience there. So it was a master class, and even in the master class he was tough.
What did you take away most from him?
I came in one time, my wife insisted that it was an Italian song, but I'm sure it was Beethoven that I was singing. Einsam wandelt ein Freund im Frühlingsgarten, mild vom lieblichen Zauberlicht umflossen. The first part of it is very lyrical, and it's about Adelaide, and he's a lover. That's the name of the song, and he says, "Adelaide, Adelaide." And then, "Einst, o Wunder, entblühten auf meinem Grabe." So the second part is a totally different rhythmically and melodically, and it has to do with the grave, a meine Grabe. He's talking about his own grave, that there's a blossom on his own grave. And Mr. Sanger was sitting, and he stood up, and he walked up to me very politely, very dignified, and he said, "My dear, what are you singing about?" And I said, he said, "Do you understand the words?" And I said, "Roughly." And I swear to God, I could see a red collar around his throat, which ascended to the top of his head, and he roared, "Roughly, you know, what do you mean, roughly? Get out of here." He went over to the piano, and he grabbed the music off the piano to the alarm of the pianist, and he slapped it together, and he pounded it into my chest. He pointed the door, "Get out and don't come back until you know exactly what you are singing about." And I've never forgotten that. That was my most memorable experience. I worked with a lot of stage directors down through the years, and they were the most crass and the hardest people to work with, and they were never quite satisfied. But I think I did very, very well. You know, I became quite, I think I was a very good singer.
And what were the moments that were so precious, connecting with your character and then ultimately with the audience and bringing those stories to life in that way? Why did you keep at it?
Well, I had read a book early on called Acting is Believing. The gist of the book was that you have to believe that you are that person. You're no longer Bob Mitchell. You are Rodolfo, or in this case, Faust. That's a live picture of me of Faust. But I, acting is believing that. I believe I became that person, and that's why that I think that that was one of the reasons I fell in love, really, with if I had a Mimi that responded to me in the same way that that I believed that I was in love with her. Que gelida manina, se la lasci riscaldar. Can I warm your hands? You know. Cercar, que giova. What's the use of searching for the key that she had dropped? What's the use of searching for it? Cercar, que giova. Al buio non si trova. It's too dark to see. And I became Rodolfo. It didn't always work. But I always tried to become the person that, that I was portraying. I had to be that person.
And how did that happen then? Studying the words and knowing exactly what they
yes.
meant.
Yes.
But did it go into reading about the composer?
And... Oh, absolutely. We have quite a library in our house. My wife said to my older son once about, I wish we had a library in this house. And he said, Mom, your house is a library. We have, I think, almost about 4,000 books in our house.
What have you learned about humankind and humanity by immersing yourself in characters who aren't Bob Mitchell? And you might not be a Faustian sort, but you became the character for the duration and over in some of the cases. What did that do for the enlarging of yourself?
Well, it made me a larger and, I think, a complete person. It also informed, believe it or not, when we went to seminary, it informed my understanding of theology and religion and all of that. And there, of course, are conflicts with playing a part that is an evil person. And, of course, I think I'm a philosopher enough to say, well, there's good and evil in all of us. And so it was kind of scary to tap that evil side of me. And also, as we were discussing because of the novel that I have just written, it was scary to touch that love side of me and be able to really love somebody who wasn't my wife. And I've been married for 55 years, and I've never been unfaithful to her, at least physically. But, you know, romantically, as far as she's concerned, I was unfaithful. And I've been trying to deal with that even as a pastor. You know, in my own life, I have never, fortunately, I don't know how I would deal with that if I had a parishioner who came to me with that problem, because it touches a nerve of my own. One of the things I do in this novel is I have Craig is kind of my mouthpiece, and he argues with God about this. He said, God, you made me this way. You made me fall. You didn't make me fall in love, but you gave me this capacity to love. And isn't that what we're supposed to do? And, you know, I'm still wrestling with this, and it's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. The book is cathartic for me, and I'm trying to deal with that. In fact, I've completed the book, and I'm already into 7 chapters of a sequel to it. One of the things I try to do in the novel, which I think I do very successfully, is I integrate my characters. What's happening to them on stage happens to them in their real life, and the emotions mm-hmm. are there. And I even describe, for instance, there's a scene from Traviata, and I tell the reader this is what it's about. Oh, suave, this is from Bohème, but oh, suave fanciulla, oh, dolce viso, dimmi te circonfuso, abbandonar. It's been 20 years since I've sung it. In terra viso, il sogno vira. And I have that in the book, and I explain, you know, I have footnotes translating it so that the reader can see it. And I describe the scene, and I I mesh that in with their own lives. There's a scene where Sasha is, she comes in, she's all alone. Her husband is out on the road, and she's broken up with Craig. They were supposed to sing, or they, so far as they know, they're still supposed to sing Traviata together in the spring. And she goes in and she sees the score, and she starts singing. And I integrated what she's singing about with her own feelings and what's happened to her with Craig.
You know these operas so well that you can do just that.
I've sung Bohème, as I said, at least 20 or 30 times. Rodolfo, of course, and I've sung Traviata I don't know how many dozens of times.
The novel's name is Licensed what?
Unlicensed Love.
And the next one?
The next one, Love Doesn't Lie. That, interestingly, you know, in the timeline of the story, we're still at Christmas. And they are to sing Traviata in the spring. So that, well, of course, I had to go and do a backstory from the college days and all that. But the story began really in the spring of 1991. And it ended really in the fall of 1991. 24 chapters. By the way, it's also a mystery. Sasha gets kidnapped. And what's going to happen to her? We don't know quite yet. And Craig goes off to sing in Glyndebourne. And it was interesting doing research on Glyndebourne, by the way. I've never been there, never been to England. And so I had to research it.
I was struck by the fact of your description of being able to weave the story of Puccini's opera La Bohème with the life experiences of the characters you're creating, the singers who mm-hmm. are putting on the opera. How do you weave the various threads of your own life? How does the singing and your going to seminary and becoming a pastor, your wife becoming a pastor, do you do that in the memoir? Are you able
yes.
to? You're able to do that?
In a way, I didn't deliberately try to weave them together, but I use a phrase. I called it my Jonah journey. If you recall the story of Jonah in the Bible, I like to say that when God called Jonah, he ran the other way. So did Bob. This happened when I was in high school. My pastor, who was a Methodist pastor, wanted me to enter the ministry. And I wanted to sing. So that's why I call it the Jonah journey. But my wife and I were always involved in the church. We always sang in churches. But I also taught Bible in church. I was always involved in the churches in which we sang. And then we both decided to go to seminary together. And that happened in 1991. And that was the last opera I sang. It was Carmen. I'll never forget it. It was November 21st of 1991. I had worked with my Carmen. We spent a lot of time together. I remember even once we rehearsed together in the basement of the synagogue where I sang. There was a scene, the scene where she does the castanet thing. It's a difficult scene to stage. And so we worked on that in the synagogue. And it was fun. We spent so much time on that. And of course, I remember that I was working full-time at Scholastic at the time. I was still singing in the synagogue. I was still singing in church on Sunday morning. I was still taking lessons. And during the week, I would take a lesson a week, and I had an opera coaching. And then I had opera rehearsals during the week. I hardly saw my kids when they were growing up. For all those years, I mean, we're talking 30 years here. And by the time I sang, Tony Amato said to me, Bob, would you like to do Forza? La Forza del Destino. He said, I'd like to mount a production of that, and he'd be good. I'd worked on it intermittently, but I'd never sung it. So anyway, and I was looking forward to this. I was going to continue what I was doing, all these things that I said. But when we sang the performance, we put such effort into that role that night. I'll never forget it. It was our final performance, and I almost collapsed because I was so tired. I mean, you can imagine doing all of this stuff, and I know I called in sick on Monday and maybe even Tuesday. I don't know whether I sang in church that morning, but I think we sang Saturday night. So I sang in synagogue that morning, I know, and I may have had a rehearsal in the afternoon, and I sang the performance that night. But I know I didn't go to work that next day, and I almost had a collapse at that point. And so that's when I really had to make the decision, something's got to go. And the only thing, the thing that I loved the most was the thing that had to go. It's one reason why I've written all these books. Somebody recently called me a Renaissance man, and there was another person who said, when I told her what had happened, and she said, "You reinvented yourself as an author." I said, "Well, wow, I never thought of that, but okay, I'll take it."
Reverend Robert Mitchell, designated pastor of St. Jacoby Church in Chihola, Pennsylvania, author of Tales of a Tenacious Tenor and Sodium Balls, A Reverend's Journey, and a novel, Unlicensed Love, and a sequel in progress, Love Doesn't Lie, speaking to us about his life in opera and the ministry and his writings. And, for example, Sodium Balls, A Reverend's Journey is available through Rose Dog Books, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And you can reach Robert Mitchell at his email address, and that's rpmitchbooks@gmail.com for more information, rpmitchbooks@gmail.com. And if you were with us at the start, you may remember that it was Mario Lanza who started it all, his mom and his maker and Mario Lanza, and how he was inspired by seeing the film of The Student Prince and hearing the voice of Mario Lanza when he was 15 years old on his birthday. Well, the Tales of a Tenacious Tenor ends the night of November 9th when, as Reverend Mitchell tells us, Debbie and I sang our only Carmen performance together. With a number of highly emotionally charged scenes we had carefully worked out, we both threw ourselves into them, no holds barred. I played José as a naive kid gradually descending into a morose, violence-laden madness from the moment she began to make fun of me when I visited her after prison. By the end of the opera, my whole emotional being was like a time bomb waiting to explode. The last straw was when she threw back the ring I had given her. I, José, stabbed her to death on the spot. Our portrayals were so successful that we received a standing ovation, rare at the Amado Theater. Drenched in sweat, spent emotionally, we joined hands to receive it together. Afterward, I felt on top of the world. I had achieved what I had set out to achieve, recognition for my art. Did I achieve my goal of singing like Mario? Oh, yes, I did indeed. But even better, I was now a much more refined and polished singer than Mario ever was. To be sure, Lanza had his own charisma and vocal excitement, but I achieved something more precious than his raw passion. The more I learned about singing and opera, the more I aspired to the brilliant sound of Pavarotti, the vocal and artistic mastery of Domingo, the lyrical power of Jussi Björling, and the literary elegance of Nikolai Gedda. If Dad equated success with fame and fortune, then in that he won. Instead, I achieved something far more precious, a high level of artistry, vocally, musically, and dramatically, that far surpassed anything Lanza could claim.